When Jennifer and I had the privilege a number of years ago to actually tour some of the ancient cities of the world that have much to do with the New Testament period, specifically we had really, really wonderful tours of Ephesus and Corinth and Athens, and I had a chance to go to some other cities when I was over there by myself. And when we toured these cities, we had our own academicians, that is, guides who really were versed in their particular discipline. They were actually, we hired them as private guides. Cost more money, but it was worth it. And they were able to answer all our questions. And I remember as we went through all the different cities, I was asking all kinds of questions. But what intrigued me most was that when we toured these cities, we would always learn about the history of the city and the New Testament times and all that took place. But what really made it interesting in a very practical level was when the guide talked about everyday life. He talked about the domestic life. He talked about how people lived, talked about even their bathroom or toiletry systems and how they ate and very practical questions about life. And the reason that was interesting is that when you learn about the everyday lives of people and ancient customs, you realize that they're just like us. They're people who have the same needs we do. Our technology and our sophistication has developed considerably, that's true, but they had the same basic needs and desires. And the reason I bring this up is that when we go back and look at ancient people and think they are so ancient, they're just people like us. And one of the ways to appreciate the culture of the New Testament is to go back and take a glimpse at the everyday lives of these people in the Greco-Roman world, to realize that not only are they people just like us, but also to get an idea of what life was like that the Apostle Paul would have faced as he went about. And so for those reasons, we move on from talking about slavery, as we did in our last class, to talk about domestic life, that is the family, and about what occurred there. There's so much we could cover on this, but of course, we're so limited in our time. We're down to the last few sessions of this class, so we're just going to kind of encapsulate some of the points there. It was Cicero, and of course, he was a pagan. He was a very renowned Roman orator who lived back in the BC period. He was a renowned Roman orator, statesman, and philosopher who once said in his writings, "There is nothing more holy, nothing more securely guarded by every religious instinct than each individual Roman's home." And that's a pagan talking about that, let alone the New Testament. So even from the ancient world, we get the idea that there was a great value for family life, for the domestic life of men and women, husbands and wives and children. And so the influence of strong families, of course, any particular culture cannot be understated. And of course, God knew this because he made us all and made culture from the very beginning in Genesis 2:18, where we find the first preferences to about men and women and the family coming together. We want to make several points, and I put them down in kind of bullet points to cover each one of them. The first thing that we can really study about the ancient world and appreciate it for us is what we call it today the extended family. And back in ancient times, the individual nuclear family was important, but so were the extended family. And there's a word in the Bible that actually conveys the very kind of family life they had. It was oikos. From oikos, we get words like ecology and economics and economy. Those words come from that. And it was the word that was translated in the King James as household. A good example of that is in Acts 16:15. In Acts 6:15, it's talking about Lydia and her household in Philippi. And it mentions specifically that she was taught the gospel, then she was baptized in all of her household. And the word household there is the word oikos, which is actually defined specifically as a particular social unit that comprised or included the husband, the wife, children, relatives, and even slaves. And again, we just talked about slavery. So even by the New Testament time, slaves were given much more value as human beings and not just simply like animals. So the status of slavery was elevated at this time more so. And so this idea of oikos, and by the way, I'll also point out very quickly, I always like to cover, you know, some false teachings that come along. People will often support infant baptism by saying, she and her household were baptized, so whatever babies they were. But of course, the idea here was the household was baptized in as much as they were people who were capable of hearing the gospel, being convicted of sin, and responding. Those are the ones who were baptized, not the infants. So if anyone ever tries to use this verse as a support for infant baptism, point out that it's not talking about that at all. But to get to my main point here, is that this was the unit that was considered to take in all kinds of people. And I found in Turkey, which is still Turkey is interesting. It's a modern country, but it's still quite ancient. One of the contrasts when you go to Turkey, as I lived there for a number of years, was that you see the old and the new right together. You can be in a small town in Turkey, like the one where I lived in Kataya, which is about 200 miles southeast of Istanbul. And as you walk through the town, you will see buildings standing that are hundreds of years old. They go way back. They look almost like thousands of years old, right next to brand new stores, because their culture is an old culture going back, you know, thousands of years. But many of the customs that they had back in the ancient world that would be occurring at this time in history was, of course, their focus on the family. And when I was there, I noticed that they have a tremendous focus on the extended family. Over there, it's very common to see many families and relatives living together in the same household, because to them, the family unit was a kind of a holy, sacred bond, which it should be for us too as Christians, but even in the pagan world, as Cicero referred, it was very important. So I saw that when I was living over there, that they still have a great focus on the family, which we all should. We should all have that. Doesn't mean we have to bring all our family to live with us. That's not the point I'm making, but that the family was very important, as be a core of values that are taught, a core for education. We pointed out in education earlier that the real beginning of the genesis of a true education is where the parents are teaching in their home, along with whatever teaching they get in the public as well. So it's important there. So the extended family was a very important concept, which is conveyed by this idea of the word household in the Bible. Monogamy was and should be, always should be, of course, the practice. The husband-wife relationship at this time was the norm. In the Jewish Greco-Roman culture, they believed in the idea of monogamy. I have to bear in mind that prostitution and adultery ran rampant, as it does today. So no new thing under the sun, as Solomon would say. So that was going on over the millennia. But by the first century in Greece, in Rome, first century AD, by the time a marriage could still be absolved by the husband or wife by an oral or written notice, they had divorce. Same thing occurs today, where you have to make it official, but you know, the idea of divorce still goes on. There's nothing new there. Jewish law actually made it so that only a husband can initiate a divorce. In the Greco-Roman world, either one of the spouses could actually initiate that. So monogamy actually was the norm. There were people who had concubines, of course, in the old, we know all about that. But that was still the norm at that time for a man to be married to a woman. Another interesting concept that started in the ancient times still prevails today in certain parts of the world. It occurs in the Eastern world. I don't know if it does in any Western nations it might. But the idea of an arranged marriage, the bond of marriage was a very important bond. It was and still is. And therefore, in the ancient world, the idea was for the parents to become more involved in the marriage through what's called an arranged marriage. The idea that the father and the mother, and especially the father, would exercise great authority in choosing the spouse, the wife or the husband. They considered personal attraction as kind of frivolous, and in a certain way it is. When you think about it for a minute, we often hear the idea of an arranged marriage and think, oh, that's ridiculous. If you think about it a while, it's not all that terribly ridiculous. It's mainly where the mother and the father are looking very carefully at the spouse, the husband or the wife, prospective groom or bride, and thinking about the welfare of that as a unit. And so they're taking a more rational approach, where we base it on the fact that, oh, he's cute and I like him, we get together in marriage. And so their idea was a whole different orientation of putting more thought and rationality into the selection process by arranging it. And that was the norm then. And as I said, it still is in certain parts of the Eastern world today. A historian, Will Durant, who's made a very powerful study of ancient history, talks in his book, The Life of Greece, and says, the Greeks considered romantic love, that is what he would call like a frivolous love of, oh, he's cute and she's sweet and they're nice, we'll get married now. They consider that to be actually a form of possession or madness. That is, to use that for a basis for marriage is kind of crazy, you know, that he's cute and sweet, you know, and that sort of thing. And there is an initial physical attraction that draws people together. But if it goes no deeper than that, then you know it's often going to happen in the marriage itself. So they wanted a more lasting bond, if that were to be possible, and therefore to really examine or consider the spouse to be much more seriously than just simply the cuteness or physical attraction. And they would smile at anyone. He goes on to say that they would smile at anyone who should propose it to, as a fit guide in the choice of a marriage mate. Many people of the ancient world and some today still look at it and think, you know, the basis for your marriage is because you're cute or handsome or strong or smell good or something. No, that's not the important part. Those might be some of the benefits that come later, but the foundation is this, and you think about it for a minute. When parents today talk to their Christian children about the importance, Josh mentioned this in class last summer, I remember it so well, that one of the most important things his father taught him, and we would have to agree, when you pick out a mate, number one is pick out someone who will help you go to heaven. And that's number one. That's far from cute and pretty and sweet and nice. And so that's the idea too, that parents today, is maybe it sounds strange to us to kind of, and yeah, I'm not saying you're necessarily making your child marry someone, but to think about those things and to point those out to your child. To look at the important things, first of all, is this a child of God you're marrying? And you know, and that isn't always a guarantee of success. I realize that too, but it's certainly a good start. We also point out, too, about these arranged marriages that start at very young ages. In the Greco-Roman world, we know from records that girls about from age 12 to 15, that they might start arranging her marriage at that age. She wasn't maybe necessarily married then, but starting to arrange her marriage then to pick out the boy. The boy sometimes being about 30, could have been younger. But again, the idea was you pick out someone who's old enough to maybe already have a career or a pathway to support the woman. And because she's young in her fertile years for having children, this continued down, I believe, through the Middle Ages and Renaissance, that the younger women who were more fertile to produce children at that age, because life expectancy, of course, was quite low, that the women would produce the children and raise them, and the father was old enough in his profession or his occupation to then support them, which is a logical idea, of course. Children, we're told from ancient records, could be engaged as young as 7. That is, the engagement would start. They wouldn't necessarily marry then, but they would become engaged then. The boys, and they would be married by 12, some of them, and the boys by 14. And again, you have to bear in mind, life expectancy was much, much lower. Back at this time, I think Paul, we're told, possibly lived into his 60s. He would have been an old man, really old man. And John, when he died in 96 AD, he was quite older also. It was rare to live that long because of hygiene and medical conditions, diseases. So the rate of life was much lower, and therefore marrying at a younger age and having children would make more sense, because if you're going to live to be an old man at 40 or 45 or 50, then you know you need to get involved with your life. Parents, as I've already said, had a lot more to do with the marriage than maybe they do today than the bride and groom. Because again, if the parents are going to arrange the marriage, the children pretty much have to accept that in the sense of yes, mother, yes, father, you know, and you come together because of that. The fathers, we know, were quite much more dominant. And again, this all comes from historical records. And so they were the primary authority in the home. And of course, the father today, in a certain sense, is supposed to be, the father should be the head, but he was much more dominant. And so their role as choosers for these spouses superseded the desire of all the others. And as I said, the father was considered the patriarch of the family. Not only the breadwinner and the primary source of authority, but he was, you know, the pillar of the family. And so his word and his wisdom would then, you know, echo and go forth and be considered almost law in the family. One of my sources said that the father spoke, and that was with law. It doesn't mean that he couldn't be wrong, but it meant simply that he spoke and the family would be well advised to listen to that. And so our idea today that one marries into the other's family carried more sway than it does today, because you truly were marrying the family into which you were going, and you weren't just simply marrying someone by himself or herself. We talked earlier about the lifestyle, the mortality. Marrying young and bearing children, which was the primary function of women, to bear the children, girls usually died young, again because of disease, the lack of the medication and hygiene that we have nowadays, and other conditions. According to one particular professor of my sources of Greco-Roman studies, medical examinations they have made of skeletons from ancient Greece, they could learn this from the forensics of skeletons, suggests that women typically died at about age 36. They're able to, I guess, have a rough approximation of the age by the bones they look at. About 36, having born about four children, I don't know how they arrived at that exactly, but they did, and the man would die at about 45. That would be considered, I won't say an old age, because many lived older than that, but that was a good prime age. And nowadays, you talk about a man living to be in his 70s, there's quite a difference in their lifespan. So we have to bear that in mind. And from about 230 BC on, as far as records tell us, a one-child family was actually common in Greece. I was surprised in learning that. I would have thought it wouldn't have been, but a one-child family, an only child, was very common in Greece. Families of five, they mentioned four or five or multiple children, were considered rare. And parents preferred two sons, I read. They preferred two sons because there's a good chance one of them would not survive because of the mortality rates and children dying, sometimes in childbirth or diseases. And the idea was if one died, then you've got a better chance of one living on to carry on the family name and to carry on, you know, the family honor. If one might have been killed somehow or died of some disease, continue. Daughters were a liability. And you may have heard of this before, but it's true if you go back and study ancient Rome. Daughters were a liability because two reasons. One, they forced a dowry. That is, when you had a daughter and she's going to marry, she has to pledge a dowry when the wedding is arranged. So you have to have that money, I don't know, like an escrow or something secured to give. And of course, many families could not afford that for whatever reason. And the other problem with having a girl, of course, was that that she could not continue the family name. She could not carry on the name. The idea of a male carrying on the name continues with us today as it was back then as well. And so the idea that parents really wanted sons. The tough thing about daughters, also girls, was that even if she were to grow up, I mean, girls did survive. If they didn't, the world wouldn't have gone on. We have to have male and female, obviously, we realize that. But the boys were preferred in a family. So girls were still born and still went on and bore children and carried on, you know, Roman and Greek families, certainly. But the idea was there was no celebration. From what I read in my sources, when a girl was born, there wasn't the celebration there was when a boy was born. The boy, he can carry on the name and he can become a father and a patriarch. The girl, well, you know, we'd kind of just kind of disappointment almost, not joy. I'm not sure if that's totally true, because I'm sure that it's hard to imagine Greek and Roman families wouldn't be happy when they see a baby girl, but there wasn't the joy or celebration like, we've got a girl now. It wasn't that as it was with the boys. As a result of that, infanticide was quite common. The infanticide, that is, killing a child or letting a child die at birth or right after birth was quite common. Abortions were common. They attempted abortions, no matter how crude they were. And ironically, in a certain kind of way, the abortions which were meant to kill were often attempted. And they ended in death anyhow because the attempt was so horrible. But the outcome was the same, though. The child is dead. So their abortions, however they were carried out, were quite crude. When I say crude, any abortion is crude. I don't care how you... You know, I don't care what you do. I don't care if it's a medical abortion, chemical abortion, or whatever it is. It's crude because you're destroying the life that God gave. But the point I'm making is the way they went about it was often very crude and not as, quote, sophisticated or medical as it is today. But it ended in the death of the girl. And many times if a girl did survive, her life was not so much better. One of my sources said that they didn't have a whole lot better life than even a slave, actually. The idea that they would simply grow up. Many of them sometimes were abandoned. The girls were sometimes abandoned because the parents didn't want them because they wanted that boy, and they would try again for a boy. And sometimes they were left at a dump or a trash site simply to die, or they were left for animals to scavenge. That's hard for us to imagine, but that was life then. And this was, bear in mind though, the last point I want to make, this is a pagan society. And this is a society, the life was hard for girls, hard for everybody, because human life lacked the sacrosanct value it has with God. And because we didn't see this kind of crudeness with the Jews as much with the Greco-Roman world. And to the pagan world, children seem more like commodities than people. And again, we might look back in horror and say, oh, that's terrible. I would suggest it's not that much different, because I'm convinced there are many women in the world today, men too, who see a child as an encumbrance, you know. Stevie Nicks, who is a member of Fleetwood Mac, if you remember way back that far, I read that a number of years ago she had an affair with Don Henley, who was one of the Eagles, and a pregnancy resulted, and she aborted it. And her reasoning was, it's going to hurt Fleetwood Mac because I won't be able to perform and go on as much as I could. It's going to kind of encumber me. So she had an abortion. That view, you can look it up, that's a factual account. The point I'm making is that that's a modern way of what they were doing back then. Like, oh, we're having a child here, it's an encumbrance, it's a commodity to get rid of it. With the focus on a child being a gift of God, no matter what the condition of the child, that gives you a whole different orientation about how you see the family. And so when we look back and see the Judeo-Christian ethic on family and the pagan Greco-Roman world, we see a contrast there. That when you go back and do not value human life the way you should as a gift of God, as something given by God, that's going to determine the way you look at it, whether it's a person or a commodity. And that's one great contrast right there. But for sake of time, I got to go on because we don't have too many sessions left. One final note I want to make to kind of bring this together, this short presentation to them. While the Bible states or implies that inception of life is at conception, Luke 1:31 gives us a glimpse that a child who is comes into the womb is a child. It speaks of it as a human being. The Bible speaks of the moment of conception, sperm in the egg, that's the inception. There's the beginning of life right there. Whether it's the heartbeat or whatever moment when it becomes a living being, that's the beginning right there. And many in the ancient world, we are told, they place the beginning of life much further along, as people do today. It's no different. Talk about that in just a moment. They made it much further along, you know, even after birth itself. A professor of biblical studies, Professor Everett Ferguson, he made this statement that Greeks and Romans do not consider a newborn an actual life until acknowledged by the father as his child. So in a certain sense, it was the father deciding, well, you know, do I want this child or not? You know, the womb, out of the womb, didn't matter. That was his decision there. And then it would be received into the family in a religious ceremony, whatever that entailed. Therefore, for those of these cultures, life did not begin at conception, as the Bible teaches it does. On the other hand, the Jewish law did prohibit exposure and abortion. When I talked about the exposure of these girls and abortion, we're not talking about the Jewish world. We're talking about the pagan world as a contrast there. But the point I'm making, too, about the interesting nature of life then and now, it isn't much different. Nothing has changed very much. Because you look at abortion then, abortion now, you look at the view of life then and now, whether the child is a gift of God or just simply a biological appendage that we can dispose of, people look at it that way today as well. And so that gives you a kind of a quick look on how the children were seen. Women, a part of this, we're talking about the domestic family here, that's redundant, but the domestic scene where families, women in ancient cultures, I want to talk about the biblical view. This is very, very important. I want to get to the end and remind you that people today want to talk about the Bible as being one of the worst things for women. Women in the Bible are so demeaned and put down and held down. No, nothing could be further from the truth. We'll get to that later on. But I want to draw you a contrast between women in ancient cultures, the biblical view, and then, of course, in the pagan world, which we're studying as we lead up to this fullness of the time. From the very beginning, of course, we know, and I won't belabor this because we should, as Christians, we should know this. From the beginning, women are accorded by God the respect and dignity their Creator gave them. God never gave woman to be something under man. Now, when I say under, he did give the man, the woman, the order in 1 Corinthians, I understand that. But the point I'm making is women were never meant to be subhuman. That's what I'm getting at. Below men in a sense. She was given to be a companion, a partner. If you want to use the old King James help meet, an appropriate help. The idea, they were to be partners in a companionship, Genesis 2:18. They were to work together. He made man, he made woman, they came together. God saw the void in man's life when he was by himself, and he filled it with a counterpart from man's own body, Genesis 2:21 through 23. So any patronizing, disparaging, or condescending treatment that we see toward women arises from the human imagination, not God's will. So if anybody wants to attack how the Bible teaches women, treats women, they haven't read the Bible. They haven't studied it very well at all whatsoever. We want to bear that in mind. And another couple of points before we talk about the Greco-Roman view of women. As the definition of woman brings out in one particular source I have, the Westminster Dictionary of the Bible says, I forgot my quotations there. The Mosaic law also and also public opinion among Hebrews secured to women the enjoyment of many rights. So women have had many rights from the very beginning. Marriage was regarded by the Hebrews as a sacred relation because God made it that way. And the wife treated with respect and accorded honor. You go back and read Proverbs 31, 10 through 31, among other passages, the woman is seen as being a queen, to be honored as such. And so if you want to speak of man as being a king, you must also speak of the woman as being a queen in the sense of being co-regnant, that is, in ruling or reigning together as God arranged that. A third point I make is that we also know, going further along in the spiritual development and spiritual evolution of the Bible, that women are also made recipients of the very same grace. The very same grace is afforded to men is also imparted to them. Galatians 3:28, we know that women and men have the same promise from God. So they are seen as equals from all the way. When I say equals in their humanity. There's never been a woman under man as being subhuman or sub-man. That's not the idea whatsoever. And when you do see that idea, that comes from the human imagination. When people turn away from God, Romans 1:25, with their own imagination. And a fourth point I'll make, and the time as it goes so quickly, as men and women might serve different roles because of their sex, we have different roles, obviously, their service to God and their work in the church, they're equally valued by the Lord, which is all that matters ultimately. Romans 16:1-4, Paul is praising women there for their work in helping him. So Paul praised them because they should be praised, and God does too. We want to take this view of the biblical. There's so much more we could say about the role of women in the Bible. I realize that. But to draw the contrast, consider the Greco-Roman world of view. We'll start with it. I know we're not going to finish. I'll start with it. Now looking at the Greco-Roman world as divorced from the Word of God, as divorced from the Bible. No pun intended there. Women of this culture stood on a lower rung of society with few rights, liberties, and opportunities. And again, if you see human beings as being commodities more than human beings, if you don't recognize human beings as being created by God, a creator, if we go back to Genesis, if you believe that, if you see women, people as only biological appendages or even accidents or just things that come into the world like, oh, well, we got this, now what are we going to do with it? If you view humans that way, just like animals in Darwinian evolution, that we're just simply higher level animals, then you're going to have a different orientation about what a man is, what a woman is, what a child is, what a human being is. Under women, in a dictionary of the ancient Greek world, a source talking about the Greco-Roman world, we have a glimpse of how females were generally regarded. This professor said, the inferior role of women in ancient Greek society reminds us that Greeks remained in some ways a primitive people. As advanced as the Romans and Greeks were in their technology and their architecture and everything else, as we talked about in earlier, they were very advanced. They were still quite primitive in their thinking about human beings as being, again, just kind of appendages or commodities. Even in classical Athens, and I say classical Athens because we often praise Athens as being the birthplace of human philosophy, which we're going to talk about later, human philosophy and how developed they were in some ways at the height of its democratic enlightenment, where it was considered to be a model of democracy for all, women were still considered second-class citizens. So even though my time is up there, what we'll do is pick up and review these points and then go on and talk more about this, the Greco-Roman view of women. We'll finish that and go on to talk about philosophy, a term people often hear and kind of cringe, but I want to show philosophy is a lot simpler than you think it is. So thank you very much for your attention this evening.